Envelope guesstimate, Dan coaxed. Oh, considering its dimensions, nickel-iron asteroids are typically no more than 10% nickel. It must be somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 or 8 billion tons of iron and 80 million tons or so of nickel. Dan's eyes went wide. That's 5 or 6 times the world's steel production in its best year, before the floods and all. There are impurities, of course, Fuchs warned. Platinum, gold and silver, other heavy metals. Impurities. Right, Dan agreed, cackling. His mind was spinning. One asteroid is enough to supply the world's steel industry for years and years, and there are thousands of these chunks out here. It's all true. Everything I hoped for, all those wild promises I made, they're all going to come true. Fuchs seemed oblivious to it all. I want to look at those striations, he said, turning toward the far end of the asteroid. His effort made him rise off the surface, and Dan had to yank him down again. Take a sample here first, Dan said. Then we can claim it. The light was so dim that Dan could see Fuchs's head outlined inside his bubble helmet. He nodded and slowly, very slowly, got down into a kneeling position. Then he pulled a rock hammer from his equipment belt and chipped off a bit of the asteroid. The effort raised more dust and lifted him off the surface again, but this time he clawed at the ground with one gloved hand and pulled himself back down. Anchor yourself, Lars, Dan said. Hammer a piton in and tether it to your belt. Yes, of course, Fuchs answered, fumbling with the equipment clipped to his waist. Dan said, Record this, Amanda, and mark the time. Star Power Limited has begun taking samples of asteroid 41-014 Fuchs. Under the terms of the International Astronautical Authority Protocol of 2021, Star Power Limited claims exclusive use of the resources of this asteroid. I've got it, Amanda's voice replied. Your statement is being beamed to IAA headquarters on Earth. Good, Dan said, satisfied. He recalled from his school days the story of the Spanish explorer Balboa when he first saw the Pacific Ocean. From what he remembered of the tale, Balboa waded out into the surf and claimed the whole bloody ocean and all the lands bordering on it for Spain. They thought big in those days, Dan said to himself. No pissant IAA to worry about. Fuchs got the knack of shuffling along the surface of the asteroid and spent nearly 2 hours happily chipping out samples and making stereo videos. Dan worried about the dust they were kicking up. It could get into the joints of our suits, he thought. Damn stuff just hangs there. Must take a year for it to settle back again. He saw a bulge off to his right, like a small knoll or a rounded hill. That must be the tail end of this rock, Dan told himself. Looking back at Fuchs, he saw that the scientist had finally anchored himself to the ground and was busily chipping away, raising lingering clouds of dust. I'm going to go up to that ridge, he told Fuchs, pointing, and see what's on the other side. Very well, said Fuchs, still bent over his sampling. Dan shuffled carefully along, worrying about the dust. On the moon, dust raised from the ground was electrostatically charged. It clung stubbornly to the suits and helmet visors. Probably the same thing here. He started up the slight rise. Something didn't feel right. Suddenly his boots slid out from under him and he tumbled in dreamlike slow motion, face forward. His fall was so gentle that he could put out his hands and stop himself. But he bounced off the dusty ground and found himself floating up the rise, like a hot air balloon gliding up the side of a mountain. Dan's old astronaut training took over his reflexes. In his mind, he saw clearly what was happening. The gravity on this double-damned rock is so low that I'm floating off it. He saw the bulbous end of the asteroid sliding slowly beneath him, and beyond it, the star-strewn infinity of space. Twisting his body so that he pointed himself back toward the asteroid's bulk, Dan squirted his maneuvering jets and lurched back to the asteroid. Gently, tenderly, he touched down again on its surface. Fuchs was still tapping away with his sampling hammer, rising off the ground with every blow, his anchored tether pulling him back again for another crack. Dan was breathing hard, but otherwise no worse the wear for his little excursion. With even greater care than before, he shuffled back to stand beside Fuchs and help bag the samples he'd chipped out. At last, Pancho said sternly, "Time to come in, guys."
"Just one more sample," Fuchs replied.
"Now," Pancho commanded.
"Aye, aye, Captain," said Dan.
He wrapped his gloved knuckles on Fuchs's helmet. "Come on, Lars. You've done enough for one day. This rock isn't going to go away. You can come back another time." Amanda was at the airlock to help them take off their backpacks and dust-spattered spacesuits. Dan caught a strange, pungent smell once he removed his helmet. Not like the sharp firecracker odor of the lunar dust. This was something new, different. Before he had time to puzzle out the dust's odor, Pancho came down to the airlock area looking so somber that Dan asked her what was the matter. While Fuchs chattered happily with Amanda, Pancho said, "Bad news, boss. Another section of the superconductor is heating up. If it goes critical, it could blow out the whole magnetic shield." Dan felt his jaw drop open. Without the shield, they'd be cooked by the next solar radiation storm. "We've got to get back to Selene pronto," Pancho said, "before another flare breaks out."
"What are our chances?" Dan asked, his throat dry.
She waggled a hand. 50-50, if we're lucky.
Tempo 9.
"We won't have to go outside, will we?" Cardenas asked nervously. She was following George through the maze of pumps and generators up on the topmost level of Selene. Color-coded pipes and electrical conduits lined the ceiling. Cardenas wondered how anyone could keep track of which was which. The air hummed with the subdued sounds of electrical equipment and hydraulic machinery. On the other side of that ceiling, she knew, was the grassy expanse of the Grand Plaza, or the bare, dusty regolith of the moon's airless surface.
"Outside?" George echoed. "No, there's a shaft connecting the temple to the tunnel. If I can find the there it is."
He pulled a small hatch open and stepped over its combing, then reached a hand back to help Cardenas. The tunnel was dark, lit only by the hand torch George carried. Cardenas expected to see the evil red eyes of rats in the darkness, or hear the slithering of roaches. Nothing. "Selene is clean of vermin," she thought. "Even the farmlands have to be pollinated artificially because there aren't any insects here." "Not yet," she thought. "Sooner or later, though. Once we start allowing larger numbers of people up here, they'll bring their filth and their pests with them."
"Here we are," George said.
In the circle of light cast by his torch, she saw the metal rungs of a ladder leading up along the wall of the tunnel. "How much farther does the tunnel go?" she asked in a whisper, even though she knew there was no one else there.
"Another click or so," George answered. "Yamagata people wanted to drill all the way through the ring wall and out to Mare Nubium. Got too expensive. The cable car over the top was cheaper."
He scampered up the ladder, light and lithe, despite his size. Cardenas started to follow him.
"Wait a bit," George called down to her. "Gotta get this hatch unstuck."
He heard metal groan. Then George said,
"Okay, up with you now."
The ladder ended in an enclosed area about the size of her apartment unit, down inside Selene. It was a cylindrical shape, like a spacecraft module. "We're on the surface?" Cardenas asked, trying to keep her voice from shaking.
"Buried under a meter of dirt from the regolith," George said happily. "Safe as in church."
"But we're outside."
"On the slope of the ring wall, just below the cable line. The original idea was, if there's an emergency with the cable trolley, people could stay in here till help arrives."
She looked around the shelter warily. A pair of double-decker bunks stood at the far end, the hatch of an airlock at the other. In between was a small galley with a freezer,